part of reconvening the hearing. Just before we come to you, Ms. Knowles, I have something that's conveyed to Ms. Banks. You will recall Mr. Goldsmith's evidence, the submissions yesterday regarding definition of residential flat. Were you here for that? No. Mr. Goldsmith made submissions on the definition of residential flat yesterday. It occurred to us overnight that that should be deferred to the definitions here. So could you make a note? I think you and Ms. Leaf, that has ramifications beyond just residential zones. It would be wrong for us to just be all within the same. And we just need to make sure that that is he's re-notified for the definitions. Now, Ms. Knowles and Ms. Wackel and Ms. Beaver.
That's me, yep. Shall I go?
Yes, whichever one of you just.
Oh, right. I'm starting off with the pages that you've got in front of you.
Okay.
And probably I'll just read with you. So I wish to submit additional material for the objection lodged by me, Sue Knowles, 11 York Street, Queenstown. The black type is the original objection, with comments in blue being the additional notes, which you'll see in the following pages. All points raised in the objection and explanatory notes are supported by the York Street Body Corporate, 27490, which acts for the four owners of number 9 York Street Apartments. The body corporate has submitted an objection separate to mine, and Angela Wareholm of apartment 9D has added to this objection and will talk to it at the session. Diane Deaver of 17 York Street has also objected separately, as well as supporting my objection, and you'll also hear from her. So the reference is high density residential building height tax mine, of course, right away off York Street. In the proposed district plan, the right-of-way of York Street, in particular properties 1, 3, 9, 11, loses its subzone D status and is designated high density. Please note that the numbers and brackets have been corrected from the original submission, which noted an all-encompassing 117. This included properties which are not relevant to the objection. I apologise for that. Right, so the map shows the location of the York Street right-of-way in relation to the lake, looking up Queenstown Pool, the circle, dark area block in the circle is the right-of-way properties 13911. The dotted line is the right-of-way coming off York Street, which comes off Harmstown Street. A high-density zone designation would put unsustainable pressure on the existing council-maintained, privately-owned right-of-way. The 14th of February 1985 Queenstown Borough Council letter from their lawyers, McCullough to Todd, attached to the then-owners, my parents, of what is now 11 York Street, transferred the right-of-way ownership to allow existing property owners to access their properties. The council, recognising restrictive traffic movements, imposed conditions, which I will refer to in a moment, and in the intervening 30 years, these conditions, dictated by the size of the right-of-way, have not changed. The transfer was due to number 11 and others losing their street frontage following the realignment of York Street, and provided for easement of all properties using the right-of-way. Council constructed the field private road, which abuts adjoining properties, and is responsible for all maintenance. Which is, you can look at the attachments later, or do you want to stop and look at it now?
Well,
I'll read the list. Certainly. The next map shows clearly the right-of-way context of the surrounding streets, with the right-of-way properties identified. And it's going to get closer on that later on. So you can see York Street, right-of-way coming off, and the yellow is the properties I'm talking about, and the properties above the yellow line are also serviced by the right-of-way, but they are now the The road is narrow. It has no turnaround area to no exit in, which is at the bottom of the road in the photo. Two-way traffic is difficult. There is no footpath or berm on either side. Because of this, as I mentioned a moment ago, council imposed conditions. Quote, the right-of-way must only be used for travelling to and from your property, and no vehicles or other obstructions should be left parked permanently in the right-of-way. This would cause an inconvenience for the other owners and those entitled to use the right-of-way. All vehicles, especially large ones such as rubbish collection trucks, have to back out. It's very easy to see the reasons for these conditions. As I will come to in a moment, council recognised the right-of-way limitations when the volume of traffic was to be increased due to a building proposal. Council said, among other things, the right-of-way had to be widened, which proves impossible. The photo shows, of course, the narrowness of it. The narrowness of the right-of-way is for access to a low-density development. Properties 13, 15, 17 and 28, which have been recognised as such, and easily identified on the photo, and in the proposed plan are zoned low-density. A major discrepancy would be created as the other half of the properties dependent on the right-of-way have been overlooked and not included in the proposed district plan as low-density, namely properties 11, 9, 3 and 1. Okay. An increase in the volume of traffic in the right-of-way, which would result from low-density, from high density zoning, would create an impossibly overloaded situation. This was acknowledged by council in 2003 when it stipulated that a proposal to develop 3 York Street, which is at the bottom of the right of way, was dependent on the developer widening the existing right of way and for all parking and manoeuvring areas to council standards. The reference to that is written in the attachment. The proposal to build did not go ahead, and undoubtedly the right-of-way widening would have been an insurmountable issue. It is physically impossible, and a substantial part of the right-of-way, if not all of it, to widen it. Buildings are already close to the curb. In the photo, it can be seen the edge of apartment block at number 9 York Street, that's on the left in the photo, is only 1.12 metres from the curb. Opposite, on the right in the photo, there is a steep drop, again private property. There would need to be a substantial retaining wall to allow widening, and this property owner would have to agree to intrusive construction and loss of land. As property boundaries, all property boundaries, extend to the curb, every property owner would have to give permission to widen the road. This is highly unlikely, and would in itself prevent high-density development. To repeat, as my original objection states, in addition, there is an anomaly in the proposed district plan arbitrarily divides the right-of-way. Properties 13, 15, 17 and 28 form the boundary between the zones and are designated as low-density. Properties 11, 9, 3 and 1 are proposed to be high density, yet are dependent on the same right-of-way to access their properties. We ask that all York Street right-of-way properties be included in the low-density zone. A further anomaly is at the same level above the lake and only 50 metres away, Dublin Street and Suburb Street, the Panorama Terrace, is designated low-density. You can see this in the map below, with the lighter shade being low density. The carefully striped bit is the properties I've been talking about. The dotted thicker line is the right-of-way coming off York Street. Other factors. Traffic volume on Hallenstein Street, which services York Street, is a near maximum. This has already produced a traffic area and a substantially increased traffic volume, and high-density housing in our troubled area of York Street would exacerbate this. Hallenstein Street has become an alternative route across town, diverting traffic from the town centre. There is a complex of recently built 18 apartments at 22 Hallenstein Street. Directly to the left in this photo, and opposite York Street's entrance into Hallenstein Street. There is no provision for off-road parking for all of its units. Number 12, immediately adjacent to 22, which is the site of Carver DD 0159, number plate, has plans for 9 2-3 bedroom residential units. Number 9 opposite is soon to start construction for 16 double garage apartments. Both complexes will greatly increase road traffic at the base of York Street. We contend that properties in Hallenstein Street south of Sandstone beyond the Queenstown Gardens, which are in flatter areas, have an established adequate road system. This area can be more easily developed without adversity, unlike York Street's right-of-way, which would be unable to cope with increased traffic. All properties in the York Street right-of-way are built on Queenstown Hill from the view. These properties were built in good faith to the regulations of the time to maximise the lake view and would be severely affected by increased height. Council has controlled the aesthetics of the area through a low-density zoning, which resulted in buildings fitting the hill landscape. There are no standout tall apartment blocks housed in the area, which includes streets at a lower elevation to the York Street right-of-way. Rather, 2-3 storey properties are tiered into the uphill slope and have been built conforming to the council's carefully controlled development of Queenstown Hill. Any high-density development on the right-of-way properties would immediately affect all nearby property values. Already this has caused concern, in this regard is an objection of number 17 York Street on the right-of-way, which is zoned by density, which is immediately above the proposed high-density zoning Diane speaks of. And before I conclude, it is useful to draw attention to the overall objectives of this section of the proposed district plan, in particular 9.26. 9.2.6, to quote, objective. High-density development will effectively utilise existing infrastructure and minimise impacts on infrastructure and road networks. High-density here would impact on the existing infrastructure and have a major detrimental effect on, quote, the existing road networks. That is the right-of-way. 9.26.4. Quote, ensure access and parking is located and designed to optimise connectivity, efficiency and safety. Again, access and parking is significantly compromised by the severe physical limitations of the right-of-way. Conclusion. This is a unique situation with an insurmountable practical problem in that the right-of-way is near impossible to widen, and as well all property owners would be highly unlikely to even though half the properties in the right-of-way will be zoned by the density under the proposed scheme, the fact that the other are omitted would, to repeat our opening premise, put unsustainable pressure on the existing council maintained privately owned right-of-way, constructed by the council for restricted use. We suggest the pragmatic solution to the right-of-way problem is to zone low density all properties serviced by the right-of-way in the proposed district plan.
Mr. McGazza, do you have any questions? On page 4, it shows, of course, lot 3.
Sorry, I'm slightly.
On your page 5.
5?
In the yellow piece, the
yep.
Lot 3, which is immediately behind the corner section, which is going to be developed with apartments. Is that inaccessible at the moment, or what's the story with it?
Sorry, what number?
Number 3.
Number 3 apartments, yes.
On page 5.
It's going, number three is only from the right of way.
Right of way.
Yeah. It's only the right of way. That line, that there, is a narrow steep staircase. So number three is at the bottom of the right of way, and the photo, which has the rubbish truck,
is there on the right of
way.
So that's all I'm built on right through here at the moment.
The apartments are in front of number one.
But you're right, number three is a
basin. Basin, right.
Yeah, number
right.
Three is
basin
at the moment.
Okay, so that would be the threat to vision amenity. Sorry, that would be the threat to your vision amenity.
What is the threat? Yes, to everybody above it.
Okay.
And ascertain to the, but more of a threat to the use of the road. Yes.
But
that's
visually
right.
Also too, if number one was to be demolished and rebuilt, that will have an effect.
I think that's going to happen shortly.
It's further below number one.
The number one, right.
The development on the corner of Halmstown and York Street is actually below number one.
I've got you here.
But visually, from number 17 point of view, if across the road developed, that would affect your view, correct? In fact, it works for everybody, no matter what happens in the world.
Yeah, thank you. I understand all of the issues you've raised. I just want to ask you one question about the traffic situation.
Mm-hmm.
And you showed us the photo of the rubbish truck, and you explained how trucks, at least trucks, have to reverse out of the right of way.
Mm-hmm.
What I just wanted to understand is, are you sure that there's no way the traffic situation through that right of way could be increased, or it could be improved such that whatever the zone is in that block of land, it could be optimised, it could be maximised. And what I was thinking of before you jumped in, I couldn't help myself, I drew on your diagram. But if that was a narrow one-way right-of-way, would someone not be able to connect it down through number one to create a one-way circuit that didn't need any reversing? Is it too steep, or is it not a problem?
It's extremely steep.
Right.
And number one, the photo is beautiful, isn't it? The photo on page four, if you look to the right and try and gauge the steepness of that down the roof of that house.
So that
roof of the house on the right hand side, that is a very steep drop. That steep drop continues when, in fact, on page 6, the photo just a bit further back also shows it. That's his backyard. It's just a very steep drop. It's the bottom coming off number 3 that we're talking about is the same. Is that contour?
Yeah, okay.
And my understanding of that is actually just here.
Yeah.
That is, I think, owned by number 3.
Yep.
I don't
know
if
the council owns
it,
it's not a plan.
Yeah.
That little right, that little, those steps are going down the hill on York Street.
Yes, there's a waterfall here. So it's not that easily visible, but unless there's a tree, they are there.
Yes. Look, thank you for that. I'm not too worried about the different ownerships, because owners have been known to work together when there's something in it for them, but if there's a topographical constraint, then yeah, that's obviously that is what it is, you can't change it. So look, that's been really helpful.
And
so
I
think
there's a topographical constraint.
It's too steep to connect a driveway to, then it could never happen, so the
who defines that?
Well, there are engineering standards that relate to the gradient on which vehicles are legally safe to travel on. So, for instance, your handbrake only works on a certain gradient, and steeper than that, so the car will just roll down the hill, that sort of thing.
And since that land was private, if the panel decided that topographically they could do that, then this is all for naught?
Well, not necessarily. Even if it was zoned low density, as you seek, landowners could still want to make the traffic situation better. So I'm just trying to understand whether it really is as bad as you're saying, or whether it could be improved. So it's not. It's not. Please don't think there's an idea of what the outcome should be at this point.
No, and I mean it is very sick. So I don't know what the rating is, but I can't imagine it being.
Okay, thank you.
There's one thing that occurs to me. So it seems that what you're asking for is a different zoning.
Sorry?
You're fundamentally asking for it to be zoned low density residential. The reason I ask the question is that you're not seeking to change the rules in the high density zone. You want a different zoning. And in reality, our function at the moment is dealing with the rules of the zone. And next year we're going to be dealing with the mapping. And I just want to be sure that that's what you want, because we can then transfer all this information to the hearing panel that's hearing the mapping, which I'll be sitting on next year, and in a way that you don't need to appear again.
Right.
Unnecessarily.
Well, I might have to search out the topographical.
Well, yes,
you've got might be quite a good point to clarify.
So to be clear, this hearing here was designed
to deal with the rules
of the high density.
Of all the residential zones.
Okay. Not what we are asking to
do. Yeah, but we've got another rule change coming up. So yes, we are talking about
we should consider that when we consider all the zoning issues in that Queenstown Hill.
Right.
Yours is not the only submission seeking changes up there.
And
so,
can we be notified so that you can appear in the hearing,
because
I'll look at the point.
Yes, we'll get the hearing administrators to note that will need to be done.
And so that's next year, and it comes under a difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
I
know you haven't finished, so who is going to talk to us next?
I just do 9.6, which is a rule change. Non-notification of application. So we'll check the 9.6,
yes,
which I put in. Right.
We're definitely here to talk about 9.6.
Yes.
Right. Under my original submission objection, chapter 9.5.2, sloping sites with a 7-metre high height restriction can have the height increased to 10 metres without notification, clause 9.6.3. The great majority of hills on houses on hill sites have been built to maximise the lake view. An additional 3 metres on new structures could severely compromise this. Quote, notice to be served on those persons considered to be adversely affected, end quote, has the potential to exclude properties. We ask that clause 9.6.3 and 9.6.3.1 be deleted and replaced with, quote, all heights increased above 7 metres for sloping sections to be modified. Words such as persons, quote, persons considered to be affected. Vague statement, open to interpretation, that would stop reasonable questioning of buildings that have heights more than what the standards state. Heights that could affect views and land values of nearby property owners. Already, the decision not notify, it has been flawed in the sense that only half the properties on the right of way got letters to say there will be a change. In other words, those on the right of way, number 11 myself, got letters to say that we were going to be making things or proposed plan. Those houses on the right of way, number 17, got no letters. And yet it adversely affects them. Hit them immediately as height. If the height would go up if this would happen. So it's not every year, but I just think that very strongly that all height increases above 7 metres, but for inflections to be known by 3 metres without notifications, which could just happen, is huge.
Yes.
Question
yes,
I think
it's
good.
A few points. I'm just battling a little with knowing your situation there. If, for example, the high density line was shifted through in front of the apartments, you would still be able to sweep from the high density height limit in somewhere on lot 3, wouldn't you?
Lot 3 would have to be in. All the right of way properties, which include 3. But there are instances off the right of way. They can't get to their properties unless they're on the right of way. Come down the road to the right of way.
But I guess from our point of view, it's not just talking about us. It means that one of the apartments I live in, if we chose in our block to knock it down and rebuild, we could go higher and lock people further behind on the other side of the right of way. So it's a tiered effect. We may only be talking about number 3 not being built on now, but I know the owners of number 3 are the 3 people in the apartment beside me. They have no intention of building on their land. It's there for them to have the view. There is another lot on number 3, but that, to us, it's not just about number, the one section on number 3. Number 1 could do it. We could do it at number 9. Sue could do it at number 11. She could build up higher and block all the people up behind there. So it has a tier effect. Diane, as you said, is absolutely effective in front of her. But if she built up, she would block people on the North Street behind her. It goes on and on.
And number 3, just to get quite clear, on page 5, that little square, that's owned by number 9, basically. I haven't done that number 3 very well. It's really the media and number 3 is here. That is basically, that's out of number 9. Anyway, that's next year, isn't it?
That
isn't
clear.
So my non-notification, 9.6 is relevant. Okay.
Is there anything else to add?
Mm?
Is there anything else?
Diane, very quickly and briefly on Diane's ego, I decided to claim, which is the beginning of the right of way. And my original submission was with regards to the right of way access and congestion, which is, if it's changed, it should be a major problem as far as emergency vehicles, fire engines, ambulances, having access through the home further down the right way. As Sue stated, there is no practical way of changing that, and the right way would not be able to sustain the congestion that was caused there. We've mentioned Hillside Street as well, further down the congestion, there is a flow on effect too with traffic. York Street is now basically being used as a route, alternate route from Frankston Road due to traffic problems that are there. And basically that's where I'm heading from. Also the fact that we weren't notified of the changes, I think it was released that I found out from other people, and will be adversely affected if it does change. So, thank you.
And so I mentioned where I live at 9D York Street, but I'm also here today not only representing myself but also the York Street Body Corporate, and we fully support Sue's objection. However, given your comment that this particular hearing has based more on the rules of the high density. I was just going to summarise and wrap up here today. So I don't know that it's actually worth me doing that. We're going to have an opportunity at another time.
Yes, I think you might be better to do it on the zoning.
And it was really just pulling out again the key factors that Sue has already spoken to. But in regards to 9.6, non-notification of applications, I'd just like to notice that I and the York Street Body Corp support having all height increases above 7 metres on floating sections to be notified.
Purposes and the non-notification section is one bit.
Right,
and the mapping bit is separate, so
you
will be notified.
We did two separate objections. But you know, that's the by the by now. So
yeah. We will make sure that happens.
Okay, so you're sure that we
will
go on.
Yes.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have your legal submissions and evidence, and we've read them. How do you wish to deal with it?
Well, I am obviously in your hands, and as you know, I was present yesterday during the airport case. So there were a number of issues that arose in questioning, which I thought first of all might be quite useful just to deal with some of those issues specifically, particularly from the legal perspective. But first of all, I would just like to introduce the two witnesses that I have here today. On my left, I have Mr. Eric Morgan, whose evidence I take it you've probably also read. He's an aviation consultant. On my right, I have Mr. Bob Fletcher. Now, we've had a little bit of a hiccup with Mr. Beckett, who, between filing his submission and today, had to have some urgent surgery. He had hoped to be here today, but it turns out that that's not been possible. Mr. Fletcher, who is the head of flight operations for Air New Zealand, I'll let Mr. Fletcher address his qualification and experience for you when the time is appropriate. But suffice to say that Mr. Fletcher has a very good understanding of the issues that were raised in the speaker's evidence. So, I hope that that's not a problem having him here today in place of Mr. Beckett.
We can be flexible.
I'm sorry?
We can be flexible.
Excellent, thank you. So does it suit you if I just run through those issues?
Yes.
Initially arising from some of your questions yesterday, which hopefully I took note of correctly and have filled in a manner that's useful. The first issue that I'd like to address is the one of applying for a consent as a non-complying activity and how that would be assessed. And I think that was raised initially by Commissioner Munro. start by noting that Barnes's general preference in an ideal world would be for new assets within the Illinois boundary particularly to be treated as a permitted activity. That is entirely consistent in our view with the New Zealand noise standard. And that standard is obviously outlined in some detail in Mr. Morgan's evidence. However, we have also recognised that there is a history to development of this area in the district. That Plan Change 35 provides some context, and so that prohibited status has not been sought in this case. The result is that that leaves you obviously a time for consent as a non-compliant activity, and subject to those gateway tests in section 104 capital D, which means of course that a consent can only be granted in two situations. One is that where the adverse effects are no longer minor, or the activity will not be contrary to the objectives and policies of the plan. Now I think that that's an important point, particularly because it means that if you are going to have a non-compliant activity status, you really do have to have some fairly strong objectives and policies. Otherwise, there is not going to be any real deterrent factor to applying for a consent in the first place. The airport has requested a number of changes to the objectives and policies, which Barnes is supportive of. Barnes' submission also outlines a few other changes that it sought. But generally the airport's position is accepted and we would advocate for the hearings panel to make recommendations in that regard.
Just on that point, Ms. Cavill, as I read the alterations that Mr. Kyle put forward, they're really along the lines of there's a certain standard of amenity levels in the zone, except in the out of control boundary of the airport. Is that really giving any policy direction?
So I agree that there is a lot of emphasis on reverse sensitivity as opposed to amenity effects per se, and that you've got these two different types of effects that you're effectively dealing with in this scenario. Having said that, when you are describing issues and your objectives and policies, and when you're talking about those higher level objectives that we now see, for example, in the proposed regional policy statement, a lot of the emphasis there arises on protecting significant infrastructure, which I think is where you get that lead through into policies and objectives around the reverse sensitivity. So it's not immediately clear, I think, from reading through at present that there is a very strong signal about the effect that might occur in relation to immunity, but there's a strong signal and a strong one sought, certainly in relation to reverse sensitivity.
So it's the reverse sensitivity objectives and policies that Barnes particularly supports, those amendments,
yes,
and additional material.
Yes. Well, in fact, all of the objectives and policies that the airport has sought that are consistent with the Plan Change 35. But there are also at least one objective in there already that talks about prohibiting or limiting intensification within the ANZ and the OCB. So that's not quite clear whether it's prohibited or limited that applies to either one. So you've got this non-compliant status that I think sends a signal, and if it's well supported by the objectives and policies, then that makes an application that much more difficult to get over the line. But associated with that, I think, is the need for notification to the airport. And that seems to me to be an important part of the package. It's certainly something that Barnes has experience of. I can think of a number of applications in Auckland where under the Manukau City Council plan where new ASAN within the ANZ equivalent were a non-compliant activity, where a number of years there, for example, where there was quite high turnover of planners in the department who were trying to apply the standard notification test, and in so doing, omitting to recognise that the airport was actually a party that was affected in a reverse sensitivity situation. So it seems to me that if you put in place those notification provisions, then you are actually giving strength to the objectives and policies by ensuring that at least the airport is going to come forward and actually defend those objectives and policies in any consent hearing, because obviously it has an interest to do so.
Can I just clarify, Barnes was particularly concerned about the air noise boundary?
Barnes is concerned about the air noise boundary, and that's largely been the focus of our submission.
Right.
But we are also in the same position as the airport with respect to the treatment of intensification within the OCB. So we've left the airport largely to deal with the aspect.
Well, I was really asking the question in the context of your notification issue.
Oh, the notification issue, I think, particularly within the ANB. So the second question I'd like to turn to is how do you prevent poor task decisions from being compromised? And I think that really that's a similar response to the first issue that we've dealt with, and that's making sure that you've got the strong objectives and policies in place. And I'd note in that regard that the legal submissions have also touched on this issue of the decisions version of the proposed regional policy statement now strengthening those reverse sensitivity objectives and policies. And obviously that's a matter to which the committee can have regard in terms of making its decision.
Must have regard,
that's right. We'd like to think that we will. The next issue, of course, is in terms of dealing with that, is Barnes' position on Rule 7.411. And so we see that as being part of the package, which ensures that that the potential for poor decisions being compounded is avoided. You retain that rule, and effectively you're saying within the A and B, you're not going to end up with a situation where you actually expose more people to the noise, and in so doing create not only an adverse effect for those people, but the potential for reverse sensitivity effects to arise, compromising the airport operation potentially in the long term. The question was also asked about potential versus actual effects. I did deal with that specifically at paragraph 4.4 of my legal submission, and I'll just highlight that for you. And that's the part that says, rather, the Environment Court has made it clear that the established use may be required to restrict its operation. There is no requirement in the definition of reverse sensitivity for the established use to show that there are actual effects on the reverse sensitivity activity. The potential for effects is enough. The definition of effects includes existing effects, future effects, and potential effects. And I would also add that it includes any potential effect of high probability and any potential effect of low probability which has a high potential impact. The definition of effect also addresses cumulative effects which arise over time or in combination with other effects. And I think that's important in terms of that issue around assessing a consent application as a non-complying activity. The question was, well, if you've got people that are already there, why shouldn't you just get another one in? And that's where you address your cumulative effects that arise over time. If you keep doing that, then you simply increase the number of people, and increases in people are likely to result in increases in complaints. Discussion was had also around a proposed right to establish as a right of residential flat, which could, without subdivision, produce an effective doubling of capacity. And again, that issue is at the heart of Barnes' submission seeking the retention of Rule 7411. 7.411 doesn't address the OCB or the area between the A and B and the OCB. Obviously it only addresses the A and B. but Barnes says that that is a way of ensuring that we are heading towards greater consistency with the New Zealand noise standard.
I think the difficult, what Commissioner Munro was raising was that the way this claim defines a residential unit inherently includes a residential flat. And so even Rule 7411 isn't going to stop a residential flat because it's part of the definition of a residential unit.
Then we would certainly like to see that clarified so that the rule, as I understand it at the moment, refers to residential units, residential flats. So if that residential flat definition remains intact, then hopefully that rule is actually going to address that issue, although I'm not completely on top of that particular issue in terms of the definition. But our position certainly would be that we would like to see that if Rule 7411 were retained, that issue was fixed, because obviously the intent there is that there is only one dwelling per site.
One household unit, you mean?
One household unit per site.
That's the point, because the definition of dwelling includes a residential flat, which inherently is two household units.
Quite.
That was what Commissioner Munro was.
Yes. So, on the topic of whether higher density properties lead people to spending less time outdoors, I would refer you to the 2003 independent news case in Auckland, which is at least partially relevant. That was a case in which a large apartment was proposed within the Mana in Auckland, which is the area between the 65 and the 60 GPA, so somewhere in the middle of the OCB, between the A and B and the OCB. That one of the key aspects of the building that was proposed was the extent of outdoor living provided by way of balconies. And in that case, the court noted that there was no research brought to their attention which showed that apartment dwellers do not also enjoy the outdoors, and that the design of the building suggested that the external facilities were important in the design of the building. I suggest that it would be an unusual building built in Queenstown that didn't have some external amenity provision for it, and that people do like to spend time, particularly in this type of climate, outdoors. Even if they don't have a garden, they will eat out there, they will sit out there, they will generally enjoy sunshine, the views, and all the lovely things that Queenstown has to offer.
Is that case in your case book?
No, it's not, but I can buy a copy to you.
Well, formal reference or copy.
So I'll turn over to Mr. Morgan, and again, he's in your hands as to whether or not you want him to run through a brief summary of the evidence that has been prepared, or whether you would simply like to turn to questions.
I'll just check whether
Mr. Morgan
has any questions.
In terms of what you've said, I mean, there's no point producing stuff from yesterday, and I'm thankful that you've added your thoughts to the mix. I'll reflect a little further on whether I still have any questions, but I think it was made pretty clear, and you would have heard my overriding concern was that the relief sort will actually work in reality, not look good in the plan, and you've had a chance to respond to that through your comments, so I don't think I have any legal questions. Although, Mr. Morgan covers, doesn't he, the NZS. I thought the NZS, as I understood it, talked about it would be nice if the sensitive uses were prohibited if practical. Not they should just be prohibited, which seems to be something that's being emphasised quite heavily through both your case and the airport's case.
Yes, and that is correct. I think that there is a bit of a misunderstanding perhaps sometimes in relation to the NZS in that regard. And we've tried to highlight that through the evidence and legal submissions, but that the NZS is very clear about what happens within the A and B equivalent. Assets should be prohibited, full stop. when you have a look at the way in which it deals with the area between the A and B and the OCB, then there is that caveat that exists. So whereas we have Dr. Charles, who makes some very broad statements about the area within the OCB being generally consistent with the NZS, the point that we've also made is that he's not necessarily addressing those two areas separately.
Yeah. No, I understand that. What I just have some questions on, and again, it might be for Mr. Morgan, but if we put aside the A and B, or the A and C, in the context of whether or not sensitive activity should be prohibited, what does repracticable mean? It's either a rule that says you can't do it, or it's a rule that says you can. I don't quite understand what the standard authors might have had in mind.
Well, I think my interpretation of where practical means is that if land is vacant, like for example, you've got a large amount of rural land that is vacant, that's overlaid by a noise boundary, that it's practicable to introduce some land use controls and limit the expansion of cash lands into that environment. But clearly, where you have an existing environment where there is already some residential accommodation and so on, that prohibiting them either means removal or some accommodation less than that.
I mean, it's an issue that's not unique to this application, but it's the interface between standards developed by technical teams under their own process and a very separate resource management process where there's an existing use right provision for existing activities to carry on, and it would seem an opportunity to stop anything new being added. But I don't, perhaps it may just be a rough edge between two separate processes, but I just, I still don't see why you wouldn't still prohibit new activities in an area where they couldn't be and let the existing activities proceed.
Can I perhaps deal first of all with the development of the New Zealand Noise Standard? It was developed in 1992, largely as a result of the RMA coming into force. So there was a recognition that we needed to achieve some consistency when it came to land use planning. So there was a direct interface with the RMA in that sense. There were also a large number of parties who were involved in the development of that standard. They weren't just technical advisors, although they were noise consultants, parties such as SANS, Development Airport Authorities, all of those people were involved in the development. So it was a very considered approach to the way in which the NZS was developed. But I'll leave you to address the other aspect of the question.
Where you've got an existing activity, the way the standard is structured is it provides for mitigation to be provided, and you see that happening in Queenstown, for example, where the airport is providing mitigation to the residents that are affected mostly by the noise. The question arises as to whether you should continue to expand that existing activity into new activities sensitive to aircraft noise, or whether you should hold the line. And if mitigation was noise insulation was the only solution, then you would go ahead and do that. But in reality, the noise effects are such that over time there's a cumulative effect. And if we were to look at Queenstown today and what we're talking about in this planning environment, and that the noise corridors predict a noise level in 2037, what you experience today is considerably less than what is likely to be being experienced in 2037 or thereabouts. And so expanding with the standard focusing on protecting the amenity for people at health effects, then subjecting more people to more noise impacts compounds the problem. And so, if you put a cap on the activity that is existing, and manage the future activity by not increasing the number of people that are affected, then you reduce the number of people that are impacted, but you also reduce the potential impacts on the airport that flow from the increasing noise levels over time as well.
Yeah, well, that's helpful. But what it does do is it brings back into focus some comments the chair made about 10 minutes ago, which was about, is the concern amenity for future users, or is it reverse sensitivity on the airport and its operators? And And if the issue really is serious noise effects coming in the future, should the plan just say, this ain't going to be a great place to live, it's going to get really noisy, and use that as a basis for the council to think about refusing applications rather than reverse sensitivity, where, as I think you know, people will just put their hand up and say, but I promise I won't complain, so there won't be a problem. I mean, I wonder sometimes if the wrong horses have been on to be cheeky about it in terms of what method would be the most robust to challenge for a resource concern.
Well, if you were to take the approach of people saying they won't complain, we're still talking about expansion in a relatively short period of time, and newcomers in a short time frame. We're talking here 20 years out, and whether those people that are residents today are still residents in 20 years' time and not complaining is a question. And the question I always ask myself is, why create a problem when you have the ability to manage it? Reverse sensitivity is clearly a potential impact on the airport. Amenity is clearly, the loss of amenity is clearly an impact on people who reside in the area. And the more people you expose to that, the greater the potential for reverse sensitivity issues.
No, I understand that, but we're also going to test all the possible methods. And the method that's being promoted just happens to place the costs on those current landowners. Another method could just be to let it go and let operators buy land that they find inconvenient, which we've heard stories through the residential hearings of neighbours buying the neighbour's property to protect their view rather than try and stop what their neighbour can do. So, I mean, that's not about saying there's an empty issue, it's about what's the right way of managing it. And we can't go in with any preconception of what's better to benefit one party versus another. I'm sure you can appreciate that.
Well, I think that's it. Why we've had Mr Morgan undertake that analysis of the number of houses within the ANZ that would be affected under the different scenarios, so that we're actually looking at the quantification of that effect to give you some basis for considering the line that needs to be drawn and the balance that needs to be achieved here. What we're saying is that there are relatively few number of individuals potentially affected by the retention of Rule 7411, for example, but that the increase in potential numbers that would be allowed by not retaining that rule is such that there is a much greater flow-on effect for the airport than there is for those individuals themselves.
That raises the question whether the airport should internalise that cost rather than externalise it, because at the moment all of that cost is externalised on those residents. The potential is removed, and the adverse effects are imposed. There's nothing in the plan that says at a certain point the airport will buy or compensate for what they're being lost, and they're particularly doing it through the zoning provisions, so there is no compensation under the Act. Isn't that correct?
No, I would disagree with that, because I think that there are clearly mitigation provisions in the plan that are provided for in terms of acoustic insulation and ventilation proposals.
But they don't recompense the person who at the moment, or without the air noise boundary in place, would have the potential to put three units on their property. And then they are only allowed to have one. Now that has a significant economic effect on that person. It's a potential economic effect, but reverse sensitivity is a potential economic effect on the airport. So where is the quid pro quo in this process?
Well, can I deal first of all with that potential economic effect argument? It's one that I've addressed in the legal submission in some detail. But when we talk about development rights, we're not actually talking about rights at all. We're actually talking about development opportunities. It's only once you crystallise your development opportunity that you have a right, and that's an existing right under the district plan. Now, you are also allowed to make reasonable use of your land. So, for example, here you have a vacant site in the ANZ, you are allowed to put a property onto that site. So there's nothing in the plan as proposed or as in the case by any party that seeks to remove their ability to put a property, to put one residential dwelling on a site. The, what is proposed is to effectively limit the development opportunities. So in the same way that the plan gives to some parties, it allows them to develop in the high density residential zone to a greater extent than they can currently do, within this part of the low density residential zone, we're saying that those development opportunities should be removed. So there's a giving and a taking away. But the law is quite clear that there is no right to compensation for the loss of development opportunities.
That's the zoning provisions are used, yes.
That's correct.
Which is why that particular method is the preferred method.
As I say, it works both ways for parties, and you know, some people make a significant economic gain as a result of the use of the zoning. Some have greater conditions imposed upon them for the purpose of sustainable management.
A little bit of a historical question. Did Plan Change 35 determine this matter?
I was involved in Plan Change 35, but I have had a look through the decisions of the court, and there is nothing in the court's decision that addresses this particular issue. My understanding is because at the time that Plan Change 35 was proposed, there was no proposed change in that private plan change which proposed to alter the development opportunities. So the issue wasn't confronted head on by the court because it didn't need to be, and the parties had already reached agreement around a large number of provisions in any event before it got to the Environment Court.
So if I was a landowner there, I would be, and I'd be involved with Plan Change 35 as there were, at its conclusion, I would say, fine, I can do this with my property in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time, and now we're going to say that they can't.
That's correct. Because we're assessing it under a slightly different environment as well, and that there has been a change to the regional policy statement since the time the Plan Change 35 was promulgated.
Thank you.
Do you know if at the time of Plan Change 35, Queenstown's housing pressures were as documented as they are today?
I don't know the answer to that.
Do you think that's one factor we might consider, in addition to things like the RPS, when considering how much weight we might place on PC 35's outcomes?
I do think it's a matter that you need to consider, but I also think that you need to consider it in the context of the number of houses that could potentially develop in that area. And if we're talking, you know, less than 20 houses, for example, in the scheme of, say, the 10,000 new dwellings that are required within the district, then there's a de minimis aspect to that. Mm. Obviously not for the potential development opportunities that are lost by those individual owners, but what we're asking you to do is to weigh those issues up against the need to appropriately protect that significant infrastructure and what that could mean for the whole of the community if there are curtailments on the airport's operations in the future.
Yes, I understand it. NZ 6805 recommends the prohibition of ice hands within the airways boundary because of the potential health effects, but the fundamental reason. Why should the plan not say that there are fundamental health effects likely to arise in that area?
No reason, Marshall.
Those effects are something that needs to be considered in terms of if you are making an application, for example, you will consider those aspects. But the fundamental issue is why should it not consider that, or why should it not provide something around that? And certainly that would be helpful. Yeah. I don't think it's entirely necessary, but it would be helpful.
Okay. Well, I think that these were the questions I was asking Mr. Kyle yesterday. The events and policies in the plan do not deal with that issue, which is actually more fundamental than the word first sensitivity to the dealing with the A and B. Because the purpose of the A and B is to deal with the health issue on residents. And that's a direct effect of the Section 5 that we had to consider.
My recollection is that the standard that's set up doesn't draw a direct linkage between the reverse sensitivity and the health effects.
Well, to be honest and to be frank, I've been dealing with the standard since 1995, so I understand it reasonably well. The standard actually doesn't really deal with reverse sensitivity. Reverse sensitivity has a practice that has grown out of the application of the standard. The standard itself deals with health and well-being of the people in the area. The application of the standard is linked to the reverse sensitivity issue as well, because the noise experts have been able to show the percentage of people who are always the standard percentage of people who are affected by noise, and if you increase the numbers, obviously you increase the percentage, stays the same, but the number increases. But I mean, I understand all that, but what I'm trying to get a handle on, if we had a circumstance, if for instance we had an abattoir in the district in the middle of a residential area, the council would be wise to say, you need to actually limit development around this because it's a noxious industry and there will be smells, there will be noise, there will be traffic, and zoning appropriately. The airport, for all its good features, and I have to admit to them, flying in and out of the town frequently, also has some noxious elements. What I was trying to discuss with Mr. Kyle, and I'm failing to get anyone to admit to it, is the claim does not recognise that those features require some separation of residential activities from the airport and its policies. It concerns itself with protecting the airport, but it doesn't concern itself with protecting the people.
Well, I would suggest to you that it does in the form of operational procedures, in the form of curfews, limiting the overall amount of noise that is made, and in addition to the curfew, identifying the noise effects that are going to occur and how far out from the airport that is, and actually limiting activity to ensure that it doesn't exceed those noise records. And the industry itself, over time, develops new technology. Admittedly, it takes time to implement them, but over time, technology does deliver improvements. If we were to compare, for example, a 1970s aircraft with a 2015 aircraft, substantial improvements in noise reduction have been made over that period of time. So
I'm thinking from the layperson's point of view. There is nothing in the district plan. There is an air noise boundary.
Yes.
The layperson, other than seeing perhaps that 7411 remained in place, that there's a limit on how many houses there. There is nothing in the plan to tell them that in 20 years' time, there'll be 2 to 3 times as many planes flying over their houses as there are now.
Yes.
Is there?
And I think that you raise a valid point that, you know, coming out of Plan Change 35, what we did get was those revised contours. And perhaps there wasn't that perhaps explanation as to how those would affect people over time. I also suggest that there's a lack of explanation around a number of aspects of the district plan generally that make it inaccessible to lay people. one good example for the contextual is the concept of reverse sensitivity effects.
Mm.
Now, to the layperson, what is a reverse sensitivity effect? There's no definition of a reverse sensitivity effect, and there's a good reason for that. That's because case law continues to develop, and so if you put a definition within the statement, then you potentially come up against something that becomes inconsistent with case law. Be that as it may, it doesn't actually help the layperson reading the plan to understand, you know, what's happening. When we're thinking about effects and amenity and that sort of thing, we, from the airport's perspective, tend to look at it obviously, you know, from the airport's perspective, and that's inevitable. We talk about reverse sensitivity effects, but you need to think perhaps about how those reverse sensitivity effects arise, and they arise in the first instance because of the effect on amenity that occurs. So it's a little bit of a continuum. The effect occurs on the person becomes highly annoyed as a result of the continuing effect, the person then bleeds, the person then complains. The complaints ultimately result in a curtailment of operations in some way, or mitigation, or whatever it might be, however that plays out. There's a number of scenarios. So although we may not have anything that specifically addresses amenity effects, and it may be difficult for a layperson to understand all of that, I would suggest that there is already a continuum there. It's reflected in the policies and objectives that deal with reverse sensitivity effects. It's reflected in the fact that there are noise boundaries, noise contours that are applied, that are anticipated to deal with the noise bucket until 2037. All of that may, however, be difficult to understand from a layperson's perspective.
Can I just add something to that? I think there is an ability for the layperson to understand the potential noise effects in the area, because there are two parts to that. One is the overall bucket to 2037, and then the airport is actually required every year to produce forecast noise contour, and I'm not sure if it, from a scope point of view, whether you can require that as part of this planning process. But it seems to me that it's relatively straightforward to deal with that in two ways. One is, my understanding is they provide that information to the council, so it is available as part of, for a planning officer, for example, to assess that and inform the applicant. The other side is for the airport to make that publicly available through its website, and other airports actually do that, publish their forecast noise effect, and you can compare. This is the noise anticipated in the next 12 months, this is the noise anticipated in 2037, there's a gap. And a layperson should be able to identify that if they buy in this area, there's going to be increasing noise levels.
That's very practical suggestion. So that's a very practical suggestion and you're quite helpful with this system.
That's often agreed through designations at airports. I'm not sure if that's the case with the airport designations.
Yeah. I think it's probably through that there is a liaison committee.
It was certainly raised during Plan Change Step 5 as a requirement.
Mr. Fletcher is also a member of the Queenstown Noise Committee.
I have a few. Ms. Morgan, in reference, you described that there were 73 existing dwellings within the A&B. Are you aware of the number of complaints from those 73 dwellings to either the airport or a Barnes member that have been made in the last 15 months?
I haven't seen any public information on
right.
that.
I could answer that. I think my colleagues have made an excellent sort of response to the questions, but just briefly, I'm a Bachelor of Engineering, an honours degree at Auckland, UK Chartered Engineer, 45 years in New Zealand, 25 years of that dealing with aircraft noise from an airline perspective, providing technical advice to Barnes, and I think you've read the evidence in terms of what Barnes. Just as a point, Barnes is a model that's used in a number of countries, Australia, the UK, etc., for representing airlines on areas of common interest to the airlines themselves. So in terms of your question, every quarter or so, the liaison committee meets. I think, from my recollection, the most complaints I've seen is most probably around six for a 3 month period, of which one or two at most would relate to jet aircraft operations. The vast majority of them have been related to helicopter operations.
And do you know if those complaints came from those properties that live close to the airport, or were they scattered around the facility?
The majority would be close to the airport, but there are the odd complaints from further out on the approach.
Okay, so let's put aside the question of the quantity, but your experience is that there are regular complaints raised in regard to what's going on at the moment.
In the single digit, low single digit.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, well, thanks for at least substantiating that there may actually be a problem.
Can I put that in perspective? Auckland is most probably the most prolific after the introduction of what we call smart approaches. They would typically run in the order of 100 to 160 per month at its peak, which most probably 80% of those would come from three or four individuals. And that's in terms of the noise exposure of those individuals, 380,000 people. Heathrow, Frankfurt, well, Frankfurt gets over 1 million complaints, electronic mostly, per year. So let's put the thing in perspective.
Yeah.
sorry.
Yeah. Most of the complaints would be general aviation out of Queensland.
Helicopters would be the.
Yeah.
There's another member of the committee sitting behind me, but I'm sure he would agree that helicopters would be the prime area of complaint. And there are mitigations and operating practices that we've been attempting to have implemented by the helicopter operators to minimise that.
If it's a fair question, and it may not be, so please just state it, you know, think it is. But because I'm asking you to speculate, I expect. But in light of the kind of meetings that are held, that are quarterly meetings, as you describe, what kind of circumstances would lead to a serious concern that operations may need to change? Would that be a sort of volume of complaints or a frequency or just the content of one really well put together complaint? What would it actually take to really give people a worry that things might be cut back?
Well, I think that, and you know, to a certain extent it's been based on experience. New Zealand's not unique in terms of complaints associated with aircraft operations. Auckland is most probably the best example of that, where with the introduction of new flight tracks, bearing in mind that we're now looking at 40 to 45 LBN type noise exposure levels for the people that were complaining. They were newly exposed to that aircraft noise. That level of complaints that I talked about, 100 to 160 in a month, was sufficient for the airport. So we have an issue. How can we better address those concerns? So my view is that six complaints, even one that's well put together, doesn't constitute a need for change, but we have in fact taken those complaints for helicopters and said, well, we know the way in which they're operating, which is causing the most of the complaints. Let's see if we can have a code of practice in the way in which those operators approach the airport in particular that will reduce the noise exposure for residents. In Auckland we've had Prices Row, the actual monitors on the inwards boundaries where we get close to a limit, then the airport and the operators talk about how we can change the way in which the aircraft are operated to try and reduce that noise impact. Yep, so Jill suggests that I just briefly refer to Auckland. I could talk about the standard I was around at the time, but my most level of experience would be at Auckland, where there were provisions for another runway, a 3,000 meter runway. prior to the existence of the Resource Management Act, and we went through a process over 7 years. Mayoral forums, consultants' reports in excess of $1 million put into the Manukau District Plan a reduced runway length at that time, with a curfew applied to it, because it was acknowledged that it was going to create a noise exposure to a new group of residents. So the area of what we call Old Papatoa constraints that still met the needs of the airport in terms of its capacity requirements going forward.
Thank you for that. Mr. Morgan, I just wanted to run through with you whether my understanding of the zoning residential development and subdivision rules is what you understand it to be. So what I understand it to be is that the 600 square metre minimum lot size relates to a vacant site subdivision to establish a lot that someone can then put a house on. But if someone wants to build a house first, the density of 1 to 450 applies. And after that's established, the 600 square metre subdivision rule doesn't actually apply. It's effectively based on the 450 that the land use was granted for. Is that your understanding? Or is your understanding you can only do 450 as long as it's not subdivided off, but to subdivide it must be 600? What's your understanding of how those rules work?
My understanding is that if you had a lot and you wanted to subdivide it, that the minimum lot size that you could subdivide would be 600.
Whether or not it had a dwelling on it.
Yes.
So I put to you that the way the rules actually work is not the way you describe it. It's only 600 metres if it's a vacant site. But if it's about houses first, it comes down to 450, and that in reality, if you wanted to make the most of your land value, you'd do the houses first, at least get a consent for them. And I think the subdivision rules reflect that. You don't even have to build it. And then just subdivide around it. But the subdivision effectively marries up to the 450, and I'm not sure the 600 square metre protection is as strong as you may be anticipating it, and I just want to give you an opportunity to say whether that would change your view on anything.
Firstly, I'm familiar with that build first and then something
yeah.
later in another location yeah. where airport noise impact could. But I think at the end of the day, if rule 7411 is retained and you have one dwelling, household unit, I think was the commissioner's suggestion, if you had one household unit, then that situation is avoided.
Yeah, okay, I'll take one. My last question, and it's a thing I raised with QAC yesterday, and you touched on it, but I'll put it to the panel as it were for you to all give me a bite at the answer. And I raised questions yesterday about the difference between a potential reverse sensitivity effect and an actual one. I understand what an actual reverse sensitivity effect is. It's the consequence of someone making a complaint that then leads to a corresponding change in an established activity. What I don't quite understand from the evidence and submissions is what people think a potential reverse sensitivity effect is. And to me it's two things, or it could be one of two things. One is just the act of someone complaining. Well, it could be three things. The first is the threat of someone complaining. The second is the risk of someone complaining. The third could be the threat of someone complaining that is so worrying that the activity proactively makes a change before the complaint is made. So what I'm trying to understand is the difference between the risk of someone making a complaint and the actual corresponding change in the activity. And the reason I've been wondering about it is that if we say the act of making a complaint constitutes a potential reverse sensitivity effect, then doesn't that mean we shouldn't let people make submissions on plans, because any established use can be complained about by people that don't want them there, for instance, residents behind the town centre zone that don't think they should lose their view. So that's one of the things I haven't quite got my head around as well. What effect it is we're trying to stop?
I'm happy to put my perspective on it. I don't think an individual complaint in itself is a reverse sensitivity. It's the fact that if you have a higher density of potential complaints, that they collectively, as inevitably does tend to occur, build a groundswell, particularly through media, build a groundswell of opposition to a particular aircraft operation activity, like the airport, and that results in some, seen it in many cases, a public meeting, local politicians getting involved, members of parliament getting involved, and then all of a sudden there is a huge pressure imposed upon the, in this case, the airport, to respond in a way that restricts the operations.
Oh, that's helpful. So you're talking about that pressure on the operator that doesn't necessarily mean complaints have been made. It just means, however it happens, there's a force exerted for change.
Typically, there's a series of complaints and media coverage and it builds. In the 1990s, there was a pressure for a curfew on Auckland in its entirety. Doesn't appreciate the fact, it's not relevant to Queenstown, that we live in a world with time zones, and if you put a constraint in terms of Auckland, then sometimes you're not able to operate services from other centres, which also have curfews.
I wonder if you're thinking about it perhaps in a slightly reversed way. This is not about people's rights to complain. People absolutely have the right to complain. What it's about is the vulnerability of the infrastructure, in this case the airport, to that complaint. In other words, what those future or existing complaints, doesn't matter which, might mean for the airport in the future.
I understand that, but again, I'm going to distinguish between the effects, the actual effect that has in terms of the airport or its operators feeling stress or panic or worry, and the potential for it, which sounds to me nothing more like we're worried people might complain. That's where I'm trying to understand what a potential reverse sensitivity effect is, distinct from an actual one.
Okay, so perhaps an example we can give to you is Wellington, which if you, and this is in another planning century, I guess. Well, it is a planning century, but it's also in when planning was somewhat practiced somewhat differently than it is today. The airport was built in the mid-50s. I get 350 odd houses were demolished, so the airport was put right in the residential area.
I don't think there was any planning in terms of town.
I was a young lad then, so I can't tell you what was happening then. And things went along, in a relatively straightforward manner until jet services started to occur at Wellington with reasonable frequency, and the flying day extended into the evening hours. And the consequence of that was a curfew, as we have here at Queenstown, an environment court action that resulted in the airport and the council having to work together to develop, one, undertake a study, and then two, develop mitigations to deal with the noise effects. And I sit on the Noise Committee in Wellington, so I'm familiar with some of the history of it and what's currently going on at the moment. And the consequence of that is, in the intervening period, the council has approved 200 additional houses, infill housing and inside the air noise boundary, and the cost to the airport and ultimately through the passenger is somewhere between $35 and $40 million to mitigate those houses. So reverse sensitivity impacts generated a bunch of consequences for not only the airport but also for the surrounding community. And so the threats, if you like, of complaints is actually a real one that in certain circumstances can convert into consequences. And another observation I'd make is, as we experienced in Auckland, is that the ability of the community to protest, if that's the right word, about the effects at the time in the 1990s when the Wellington situation arose, is compounded today by social media and the ability for people to galvanise, if you like, pressure into any piece of infrastructure or any operator of infrastructure to make change in the environment. So, in my opinion, you take NZ6805 and you take the experience that now global around noise management at airports and you shift away from those principles in 6805 with careful consideration. I accept that you've got to balance existing use with the recommendations and the standard, but at the end of the day I think if you move away from those you have to very, very carefully consider the potential consequences of doing that.
Sure. We've had a couple of instances like the one that was put on the Protective Society some years ago where a campaign effectively got a helicopter landing site out of Rath Sport, which was used by Rath companies, shut down. I don't think that went to the Environment Court. A very more recent one, it did go to the Environment Court with the Skyline landing where they said that what could happen up there. With your reverse sensitivity stuff, is that linked to the Environment Court?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
No, well, the Environment Court will make decisions on that sort of thing. They're looking at this whole thing, this is what we have to allow the money to speak to the laws about the plane goes. At what point might the Environment Court then become involved in looking at reverse sensitivity effects and the consequences of those?
One of the very clear examples is the independent use case that I was referring to earlier, and that was the situation in which there was a proposal of a non-compliant activity to build an apartment within the area between the 60 and 65. And what you had in that situation was an appeal by a number of parties to the granting of consent, and so that's how that kind of issue can be dealt with before the Environment Court. That's just one example. Another example might be with respect to district plan provision, designation proposal. There are a number of kind of mechanisms by which the Environment Court gets to consider reverse sensitivity issues. Abatement notices of both sides of the court. Just some of the examples.
Thank you.
I'll ask questions as we've gone through them. First, the Munro residents, which we've got there. Extra class.
Can I ask for one more question? Are you comfortable that if we were to retain 7411, but we still felt that fundamentally the plan to let each section have a house and a family flat or residential flat. Quite clearly you'd rather see one household unit only. Are you comfortable your submission has enough scope that we could, if we were to agree, effectively go further than what you've actually said to us today, possibly, and just say no residential flats? Certainly in the A and B, maybe the only two.
Yeah, look, I think there's probably a number of different ways of fixing that up if it needs fixing, and that's obviously dependent on the way in which some of the definitions fall out of the plan as well. Barnes' position is quite clear, it wants to see a provision in there that prevents additional residential units, whatever you like to call them, but additional provision for more people within that area. However you achieve it.
I would argue to minimise because we've gone past the prohibition. And there are pragmatic enough to sort of acknowledge that there are going to be opportunities to have some limited number of dwellings. But my perspective on that 600 lot is that, because we were discussing this morning, because I was confused, maybe as well versed as my colleagues on this, but it seems that if you've got a 1200 metre section, you can divide it into two, 600 metre provision. If you have 1,050, you're able to sort of squeeze a 450 out of it, without necessarily creating a subdivision, you can put two dwellings on it. That's our interpretation of that 450 criteria. I don't know if it's a cross lease or something that provides for on a single unit title to household dwellings, but
we've got 900
criteria.
So we've got 900 metres out there in common size, which applies to.
Yeah.
And what else? It's the assessment that Mr. Morgan's done, looking at those different roles and what the effect might be in terms of the additional numbers of dwellings. I'd say that's helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity to come clean.
I'm here for a living.
Thank you.